Yes.
Before we start, in case something should happen, do you know what my redial number would be? Should I just...
911, I don't know, John.
I'll just dial the council then.
Yeah, do that. Dial the council and they can run somebody down here. Unless you just kind of want to keep whistling so I can tell if you're on there. Sing along.
A little annoying.
Okay, well, yeah, if we drop you, call Della upstairs and she'll get us fixed.
Okay.
Okay. Dwayne, are you trying to start a combine?
I'm up next to the shop. They're running a grader out there.
Oh, okay. No, I think we're on it. That clock's a little fast.
Is there a way to stop noise from this end going that way?
Well, I can...
Hit the button again, and then I'll still be able to hear him.
Oh, yeah. Can you hit the mute on your end, and then when you want to talk, unmute? And because if I mute this end, we won't be able to hear you guys.
I found the mute button, John, so I can shut the grader off.
That away.
We'll call the meeting of the Administrative Rules Committee to order. And welcome, all of you. Good to see you again. And we'll ask the clerk to, excuse me, the council to take the roll.
Representative Koppelman.
Here.
Representative Ammerman.
Here.
Representative Bow. Representative Boehning. Representative DeCray.
Florida.
Representative Devlin?
Here.
Representative Franzbach?
Here.
Representative Craver?
Here.
Representative Munson? Representative Schatz?
Here.
Representative Thorson?
Here.
Representative Wrangham?
Here.
Senator Andrist?
Here.
Okay. Senator Fisher?
Here.
Senator Freeburg?
Aye.
Senator Heckerman?
Here.
Senator Klein?
Here.
Senator City?
Here.
Ooh, 100% for senators. They get a gold star today.
Records show that Representative Boehning is here.
Oh, okay.
Walked in.
Oh, okay. Just a comment by way of the phone hookup in discussing with Chairman Koppelman, just to advise the committee that going forward, we will probably not allow conference call participation. The Legislative Council Chairman has kind of passed the word along that he really doesn't like the idea and thinks that people should get here if they at all have that opportunity. So because that policy was sort of unknown until we started asking around, for today's meeting we're making that accommodation, but going forward it'll be a lot harder. Not impossible maybe, but a lot harder.
You just left the door open a crack.
Chairman, it's nice to know I'm an exceptional person.
You are. You and Representative DeCray definitely are exceptional people. We welcome you by phone link. We'll ask all of you have had an opportunity, hopefully, to read the minutes. And are there any additions or corrections? Move to approve. Is there a second? Seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed? Okay, motion passes. Minutes are approved. The first item on our agenda today, and we hope, this is our short agenda, by the way, members of the committee, so we hope to keep to our timeline. I know some of you have other obligations and need to get down the road as well, and we don't anticipate this being a long, drawn-out meeting. And the future ones, however, we expect to have more rules on the docket. So today we'll begin with the rules from the State Board of Nursing. Please come forward.
Hit the button on that.
There you go. I'll start over. Thank you, Chairman Koppelman, members of the committee. My name is Brian Bergeson. I'm the Special Assistant Attorney General for the North Dakota Board of Nursing. We are here today just to request the deletion of some of our rules. There was a couple of bills passed in the last session that made some of our rules obsolete. I'm assuming it's in your packet there. I think Mr. Wallstead did a good job of going through the rules at our request and pulling out the obsolete portions. I will say, though, that I'm going to make a verbal request here today. I think we got a little aggressive on a couple of our rules. So there are three sites that I gave to Mr. Wallstead earlier today. I guess just for the record, the changes that were made in section 54010301, subsection 63, the rule in 54-07-01-03, and then
excuse me for interrupting, but members of the committee, I think this is the standalone piece, isn't it, John?
The standalone piece is the rules with the requested deletions to show the deletions.
They aren't in this book.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Do we have okay, please continue.
Sure. And again, for the record, those are just there for those other registries that come up from time to time.
Okay, questions from the committee?
And if I could add one other thing, Chairman Koppelman, as part of this expedited rule process, we have provided notice to all of the interested groups, you know, the Nurses Association, etc., that we would be here. That's part of the rule or the statute that allows us to come here is making sure all the other interested parties are knowing that we're here.
Okay, very good. Any comments or questions from the committee? All right. Again, unlike most of the rules that we review as they're being made, they require no action to go into effect if we have no concerns or objections or wish to hold them over or avoid them. These, on the other hand, because they're being voided, do require a motion from the committee to delete the ones proposed. So do I hear such a motion? I guess if we do nothing, the rules stay in place. Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we delete the rules as requested because of the changes in North Dakota law.
A motion, is there a second? Moved and seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is the State Water Board, or State Water Commission, I'm sorry.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Bob Shaver. I'm the Director of the Water Appropriation Division at the State Water Commission. And we're requesting a deletion based on House Bill 1107 for non-commercial gardens under irrigation. And just to give you a brief history, the previous session, 09, we exempted, or the legislature exempted irrigating more than 1 acre, up to 5 acres. Prior to that session, if you irrigated more than 1 acre of land, it would require a water permit. We recognized that there were a number of small little truck gardens. If you had a raspberry patch or a strawberry patch, a couple of acres, and were selling those, it would require a permit, and we didn't think that that was really necessary. So that bill was approved and enacted. an oversight on my part, after that was approved, the Century Code still listed non-commercial gardens, so that they were emphasizing, we were saying, we, our intent was that 5 acres or less irrigation, whether it's commercial or non-commercial, you don't need a permit. And it was an oversight on my part not to delete the term non-commercial. And we did that during this session under House Bill 1107. And so now we needed to look at Administrative Rule 890303-02, the definition of domestic use. And I handed that out to the committee members here. And it's just showing we're kind of doing the housekeeping here and deleting, as per Century Code, the non-commercial as described under the definition of domestic use.
And, sir, that is, Mr. Shaver, that is 890303-02, is that the...
That's correct, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
And members of the committee, if you haven't located that, the entire rule should be on a separate sheet in your information there. And the one being deleted is also attached to a letter that should be there in your pile from the state engineer. All right, thank you, sir. Questions for Mr. Shaver? All right, seeing none, again, this is a request to void an existing rule, so we would need a motion to do that. Senator Klein. It's been moved to delete section 890303-02.
Second.
And been seconded by Senator Citi. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. We'll move on to the representative from the Board of Medical Examiners. We're ahead of schedule. How about that?
Just a point while we're in a moment of silence. Mr. Chairman, those technically would be roll call votes, those last two. But since I heard no nays, I just marked everybody as voting yes. No, no sweat.
Mr. Hodak.
Thank you, Chairman Koppelman, members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Hodak. I'm the Executive Secretary of the North Dakota State Board of Medical Examiners. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony this afternoon. I followed Mr. Wallstedt's questions in that he set forth in his letter to us. And on the first page, there is really nothing there to note other than when we gave notice of these rules and held our public hearing, I would just let you know that we received no comments, and we still have not. I mean, long after the comment period is closed, we haven't received any comments at all on these. So if I may perhaps get to the explanations of each rule.
Please do.
The first one, 500207.101, is a fee increase of a physician's annual registration from $150 per year to $200 per year. And I did a regulatory analysis because in total this meets that threshold, and that's attached to the back of my testimony. But if I could just point out a couple of things with regard to that increase. First of all, I think it's important to note this is the first increase the board has imposed on physicians since 1997. So for 15 years we have had the same fee and had no increases of any other kind either with regard to a physician's license. And you know, I did a little look at the inflation, and we're still below even the rate we were back in 97, given the increases that have happened since then. In the regulatory analysis, I also note that We are still below the national average in medical license fees, and we're competitive with our surrounding states. They are, we're increasing to 200, they have been at 200 or 190 in the case of Minnesota for some time now. To compare it to other things within the state, we're the same as dentists now that the increase is proposed here, and we're about half the price of lawyers. Now I know many will think that's still out of whack, but I pay about $400, $385 I think, for my annual law license, and so this isn't a bad deal when you look at it that way. But you know, given all of that, we still wouldn't do it unless we had a need for it. I mean, part of that obviously is that you know, dealing with budgets all the time, that there have been increases since 1997, and we've had those in rent and other expenses as well, while our revenue has remained relatively flat. But beyond that, there are two things that we're doing that I think are just part and parcel of our mission to protect the public. And the first is, we host a physician's health program. And I know a lot of people aren't aware of it because it's run confidentially, and that's one of its benefits. We allow physicians who have mental health issues or who have chemical dependency issues, but who have not harmed any patient, to enter our program, and we provide monitoring, drug tests, you know, UAs all the time. We hook them up with a psychiatrist if that's appropriate, or with a treating physician, and we receive quarterly reports from them with regard to that, with the whole purpose being that if we can stop this addiction or stop this mental health issue from becoming an impairment that hurts patients, then I think we've done our job to protect the public. And when you think of how many patients one doctor sees in a year, if we can save just one, that's thousands of North Dakotans that will be getting medical care. We currently have about 28 or 29 doctors in that program. Many have told us from the outside, and we've been in this review process for months now, that we could have many more if we had the program hosted outside of the board. And intuitively, that makes sense. If you're a license holder and you have a problem, we're not going to be the first place you call. I know I'm not on anybody's speed dial when they've got a problem. So the thinking is that if we move it outside of the board itself, but maintain a relationship that allows us to keep track and make sure it's doing its job, it will still be under us, if you will, but it just won't be hosted by us, and we won't be doing the day-to-day things, that would be of great benefit. That decision has yet to be made, but even if we keep it inside of our board, there are still major improvements that we want to make. Increased monitoring, the assignment of a medical doctor to each case so we can more individually tailor the program, treatment program that's needed to keep someone from relapse. So I think there are things we would do either way that will be of significant public benefit. The costs of that alone, if we end up having to bear it all, will absorb this complete increase. We'd get about $150,000 or $160,000 out of this fee increase, and we will be spending that for sure on this type of program. We're going to try and get help. There are other boards that may want to join us in this program, and we will make that assessment and try to do that if we can make it work. That's a little dicey because everybody's got a different look and everybody's got a different purpose, so I'm not here to promise you that, but we're certainly looking at that and trying to defray some of the costs. That plus, you know, the fact that we've had the creep, the budgetary creep that everybody else has had, exists for us. But then the third reason is we have a website that, frankly, I'm not very proud of. I don't think it serves the public as well as it could. And so within the last couple of months, we did an RFP through the State Procurement Office, and we awarded a contract to Albertson Consulting, which is a firm in Minot that does this work. And we advertised it nationally, and we got bids from North Carolina, we got bids from Oregon, and we did it straight up, and Albertsons came out with it, and I've got to say I was pleased with that, and I'm pleased the way it's going. We've had maybe half a dozen meetings with them, and we're making real progress. But the point is, people are going to be able to go on our website, get instant information about disciplinary actions against their physicians or any physician they want to look up. They're going to be able to see specialties, a lot of things that we just don't have there now. And I think that's going to be a significant public service because people are interested to know if a doctor has been disciplined, what was it for? What was it about? Did he do a procedure wrong? Was there alcohol involved? Was there a patient boundary issue? Right now, all we say on our website is this doctor has been disciplined, and then they need to call or write us to get the documents and to get the information. This will put it right there, and it will make what we're doing much more transparent to the public, which is what I think we should be doing. So that's kind of the shortened version of why we're seeking this fee increase. The other rules, frankly, are, I think, less notable, but let me comment on them. Under B on page 3, 5002.1103.1 provides an exception to our requirement that a doctor pass each step of the licensing examination in no more than 3 attempts. Every state, just about every state, has some rule like this. You don't allow a medical student to just take the test over and over and over and over till they finally get lucky and pass it. There are limits on how many attempts a student can take. Ours is 3. And so we've had that in place forever, and frankly it doesn't affect very many doctors because usually they pass it on the first try. But we do have some doctors, for whatever reason, illness while they were taking the test or just circumstances, that do need more than 3 attempts to pass a component of the test. This would allow us to give those doctors a license despite the number of attempts if they're validly licensed in another state and have practiced there for 10 years. They haven't been disciplined during that time, and they're board certified, so that we have some other indicia that they are good doctors, and we can kind of ignore, if you will, those number of attempts. So I think this is a move on our part, although, a half step perhaps, in just trying to be inclusive as we can, maintaining our core purpose of protecting the public.
Mr. Hodak, I've been told what we call those folks who take more than 3 tries.
Lawyers?
Doctor. We'll call doctor, I understand.
That's true.
Let me stop you there before you go on and see if there are any questions on the 2 points you've covered. Senator City.
Mr. Chairman?
Just a moment, Senator Adams. We'll get to you next. Senator City has got the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dwayne. Could you please tell us if we have, we've been reading a lot about foreign docs and their training maybe not being up to par. So let's say that someone comes from another country and works in another state. Do other states have comparable licensing requirements, or are some states known to be much easier to get licensed in so that we would be providing a gateway for some of these other docs to come into North Dakota with this loosening of our requirements?
Mr. Chairman and Senator City, I don't think this change in itself would provide that. There are some states, frankly, and I hope they're not listening here, that are known for being too easy to get into, that have kind of a bad reputation in that regard. We're kind of middle of the pack, I think, if you will. The legislature took a step with regard to international medical graduates this past session. At our request, because of the difference in medical education, we had required 1 year of United States or Canada-trained physicians in postgraduate training. That's, we often call that residency. So the UND Centers for Family Medicine, those doctors who are training. We required 1 year of U.S. doctors and 3 years of international medical graduates. The thought being that it took some extra time to get up to speed. We asked the legislature to reduce that 36 months to 30 months for international medical graduates, and you did that this last session. I think that more nearly addresses your question, and I think that will be attractive, frankly, to those doctors.
Thank you. And if I'm reading the rule correctly, Mr. Hodick, this does allow discretion, so you do it on a case-by-case basis in terms of when the exceptions are made?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. I mean, we have to meet those specified things, but the board is given discretion within that parameter.
Very good. Senator Andrist, I believe, had a question.
More of a comment, Mr. Chairman. I really applaud most of these rules. I particularly like, and I think all rules should have opportunity to use discretion to make exceptions, because almost any rule, sometimes you find out where it really doesn't apply for, shouldn't apply for a certain person. So I particularly like that provision. I don't have any problems with the rules. I do think the very last one, where they triple the fee for a late PA, is pretty excessive, but otherwise I think it's a good set of rules.
All right, thank you. And Representative Ammerman, I think, had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dwayne, when you have physicians with the within the mental health program or dependency program, and then you also have your website where the public can go and look up about physicians' history, so on, because of HIPAA. If they go to your website, is any of the, if they're under in the mental or the other dependency, will they be able to public find that out, or is that protected?
I'm Mr. Chairman, Representative Ammerman. We're largely exempt from HIPAA, but to answer your question directly, no. When we invite someone into the physician's health program, it is done on a confidential basis. The only exception to that is sometimes when we discipline a doctor for a patient care violation, we will also order them into the physician's health program. Then that's a matter of public record, because our disciplinary orders are public. But if they're just invited and doing it voluntarily, we never mention their name in any way.
Mr. Honeck, I have just a follow-up to that. I guess when you're dealing with the disciplinary area, as you indicated, you're usually, as I understand it, talking about perceived injury to patients or to the public as a result of some action by a physician. In this program, however, you could be dealing with illegal activity if there are prescription drugs that are misused, if there are, whatever. How do you deal with those situations?
Mr. Chairman, you've kind of hit our balancing path, the line we walk on. I don't know if you may not have heard, but in California, the state legislature did away with the physician's health program because they found it was shielding doctors who were continuing to hurt patients. I've said from the very beginning, this is not a diversionary program. We will never discipline a doctor and hide him in this program. If we discipline him, it's in the open and people will know about it. So the way we walk that line is, someone can join our program only if, after we investigate it, it is shown that there would have no basis for bringing a disciplinary action, that there was no patient harm at all. If patient harm has occurred, it's too late. It's too late for this program to be confidential.
And how do you assess whether there's patient harm? Because I can envision circumstances where maybe you wouldn't know or hadn't been reported.
We don't stop at the report. We investigated. We talked to people. We talked to the hospital. In some cases, it's easy because, you know, we disciplined a surgeon a couple of years ago who was operating at a 0.35 blood alcohol level. That was pretty easy to tell. You know, it didn't take rocket science to figure out. We put that surgeon in the physician's health program, but we did so publicly. So we will look at the patients and see if there's any indication of harm.
Very good. Other questions or comments from the committee? Senator Sitti.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hodick, when we think of this last session and we passed a bill that stealing of one prescription drug makes a person a felon, I'm just thinking of doctors' access to prescription drugs, and I'm wondering if you are enforcing that if a doctor would take, you know, abuse one prescription drug, would he be turned over then to law enforcement as a felon?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sitti, the short answer is yes. We have everything we do as an investigation is confidential, but the legislature has put in an exception where if we see evidence of a crime, we can turn that over to law enforcement, and we regularly do. Obviously, we can't do anything more than that because it's up to the local state's attorney to determine what gets charged and what does not. But our job is making the referral at that point. I should mention one other thing in that regard, and it's something the legislature did in 90, well, it's, we've been using it for about 3 years heavily, and that's the prescription drug monitoring program that the Board of Pharmacy runs. That is an absolutely invaluable tool. And whenever we get any indication that there's a mishandling or anything, we can go to that tool and see every prescription that physician wrote, every recipient of those prescriptions, the date, the time. It makes this job much, much easier.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? All right. You have another area to cover, correct?
I do, and I'll do so quickly. C&D, first 5003.0116 gives a 31-day grace period to physician assistants who forget to renew their license. Every year, we don't have many, but we have a couple, doctors and physician assistants who just forget to renew. They're duly licensed, they're qualified, they just don't do it. We started giving doctors by rule a 31-day grace period 2 years ago when we got a word that one small hospital was going to suffer about $250,000 loss because the insurance company wouldn't pay for him because his license had expired. So what we do now is within that 31-day period, we'll give them a retroactive license back to the day it expired, and that takes care of that insurance question and covers them. The next one, D, is the one Senator Andrus mentioned, and Senator Andrus, in my defense, I will only mention that this is an administrative version of a law the legislature passed imposing triple damages on a doctor who fails to renew. So we figured it was only fair if we did the same for physician assistants.
Okay, comments, questions? All right, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hodick. Appreciate it. Let's see, we're a little bit early, but do we have the representative for the State Board of Psychologist Examiners present?
I might say, Mr. Chairman, if the speaker device could be a little closer to the presenter, I might be able to hear a little better.
I'll leave that to our technical expert here.
Okay.
If not, we'll stand at ease for a moment. I think that next presenter is up at 1:45, so take a 5-minute break.
I was assured that this thing would work swell. I really don't even know where the speaker is.
I can hear you really good, John.
Yeah.
John, I think if they just be closer to the mic, it probably help.
Yeah, that probably is true, too.
Yeah, I believe that if the speaker is picking it up, you should be able to hear it, but when not, we can still hear him because we're in the room, but you're not picking that up, so.
Yeah. Well, don't fuss about it. I just thought.
Well, maybe we just. I'll just ask him to caution the speakers to talk into the microphone.
You know, the main penalty.
Well,
I'm 100% of that Boris.
Okay, we'll call the meeting back to order, and we're still a little bit early, but do we have the representative from the State Board of Psychologist Examiners present? Yes, sir. Please come forward.
Maybe you can ask the people at the podium to talk close to me.
Our distant friends can hear.
And we'd like to ask you and the other presenters today to make sure to get as close to the mic as you can on the podium, because we have a couple of members joining us by telephone link and they're having trouble hearing the presentations from the podium. Thank you. Go ahead. I guess we're short a couple on this side if you have extras. Okay. And proceed.
Chairman Koppelman and members of the Administrative Rules Committee, I'm Dr. Alan Fair, clinical psychologist and past president of the North Dakota State Board of Psychologist Examiners. I'm here to testify and answer questions about the October 2011 rules of the board. A letter from this committee inviting us to testify had posed a number of questions which I will address in order. Question number one, whether the rules resulted from statutory changes made by the Legislative Assembly. Yes, there are several examples. A, previously there were allowances for individuals to be licensed as psychologists who were graduates of programs that were considered to be substantially psychological in nature or were considered to be equivalent to psychology programs. The current North Dakota Century Code section 43-32-20 requires that applicants for licensure have completed an accredited program. Therefore, the guidelines for equivalency or to determine whether a program is substantially psychological in nature is no longer relevant. The new standard is for programs to be accredited. Therefore, those sections are being deleted from our rules, which includes chapter 66-02-02, pages 21 through 25, and section 66-02-01-12, which starts at the bottom of page 16 and continues to the middle of page 20. B. North Dakota Century Code section 43-32-27.1 had allowed for the board to establish procedural exceptions for processing multiple complaints from the same complainant. This procedure is listed on page 13, section 66-02-01-07.1. C. Requirements for licensure have required applicants to complete a year of internship and a year of postdoctoral residency. North Dakota Century Code 43-32-20, subsection 1D, changed the wording from 1 year of which must be postdoctoral to 1 year of which may be postdoctoral. This allowed for both years to be predoctoral, but the guidelines for the second year needed to be defined. This is listed in section 66-02-01-11.1, which begins at the bottom of page 13 and continues to the middle of page 16. Question number two.
Whether the rules are related to any federal statute or regulation? No. Question number three. A description of the rulemaking procedure followed in adopting the rules. The board published the abbreviated notice of the hearing on the rules in each official newspaper at least 20 days before the hearing. The hearing was conducted on May 17, 2011. Nobody appeared to comment. Question number four, whether any person had presented a written or oral concern, objection, or complaint for agency consideration with regards to these rules. The board did not receive any oral or written or oral complaints or comments on the rules. Question number five, the approximate cost of giving public notice and holding any hearing on the rules and the approximate cost of developing and adopting the rules. The cost of giving public notice was $1,457. The cost of travel and phone calls is estimated at $250. Question number six. An explanation of the subject matter of the rules and reasons for adopting these rules. In addition to the changes to comply with North Dakota Century Code changes, the following also reflect changes to the rules. A. On page 11, the Executive Secretary's name and contact information is updated. B. On page 13, the Ethics Code is updated to the most recent version. C. Section 66-02-01-08 on page 13 provides a modest increase in the license application fee and an increase in the renewal fee as allowed by North Dakota Century Code 43-32-13. These changes are necessary to fund board operations. D. In the middle of page 16, there is a reference to a condition that expired on January 1st, 2010. Since it was outdated, this reference was deleted. E. In section 66-02-01-12.1 on page 20, there is a listing of two additional accrediting bodies as allowed by North Dakota Century Code 43-32-20. Question number seven. Whether a regulatory analysis was required by North Dakota Century Code section 28-32-08 and whether that regulatory analysis was issued? No. Question number eight. Whether a regulatory analysis or economic impact statement of impact on small entities was required by North Dakota Century Code section 28-32-08.1? No. Question number nine, whether these rules have a fiscal effect on state revenues and expenditures. The board does not receive any state general funds. The board is primarily funded through renewal fees. The renewal fees were increased as authorized by statutory change in 43-32-13.
Sir, let me stop you there. I think we can see the answers to the other two are no, and please proceed with any other description, or do you feel that you've pretty well described the rules in what you've read for us?
I'm happy to address any questions.
Okay. Questions from the committee on specifics in the rules? I do have one with regard to the listing of your executive secretary. Have you always had that in the rule, and is there another place that your membership or the public could find that individual? Because I'm just thinking, if that changes periodically and you have to go through rulemaking to restate it, it's a little bit inefficient. Is there a website or a state document or something that you could refer people to?
Actually, there is. We have both a website, and our website is now listed on our rules, and you're correct that every few years there has been a change in the executive secretary. Also, there's a, if someone goes to the governor's page, it links to our board, and so there's a link from the governor's page.
Would it make sense, do you think, then, to just, instead of listing it the way you have it here, to just have a reference to that web page? In your rule, and that would alleviate having to come back every time those changes are made?
That would be fine. That would be a good idea. We have published our website to the North Dakota Psychological Association, so the majority of psychologists in the state should already be aware of and utilizing our website.
Okay. We have the authority on the Administrative Rules Committee to agree with you to modify a rule, so that might be an efficiency if a member of the committee wants to make that motion, and you've already verbally agreed to it. We could clean it up that way and maybe allow you to give council the actual web address so that they could state it specifically. Representative Franzbach has moved that. Is there a second?
Second.
All right. Do we need a roll call on this?
Yes.
All right.
Who was the second?
Second was Representative Kraber. Any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, we'll ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Koppelman?
Yes.
Representative Ammerman?
Yes.
Representative Boehning?
Yes.
Representative DeCray?
Yes.
Representative Devlin?
Yes.
Representative Franzbach?
Yes.
Representative Kraber?
Yes.
Representative Schatz?
Yes.
Representative Thorson? Representative Rangham?
Yes.
Senator Andrus?
Yes.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator Freeburg?
Aye.
Senator Heckerman?
Yes.
Senator Klein?
Aye.
Senator City?
Aye.
Unanimous motion carries.
Very good. And that motion is carried. Further questions or comments on the rules that have been presented? You're getting off easy.
Thank
right.
you very much.
Seeing none, thank you. Next on the agenda, our 205 item is a presentation by a representative of the Department of Human Services regarding October 2011 rules.
Chairman Koppelman and members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Alm. I'm an attorney with North Dakota Department of Human Services. The rules that are before you are 7502.7.1, rate setting for basic care. The rules are not in response to legislation or federal enactments. As my report that I handed out, paragraph 3 and 4 explains our notice and the public hearing process. The department received one comment on the proposed administrative rule, and that was 275.02.07.1.20, and the rule was changed to address that comment. Paragraph 5 of the report also explains our cost of rulemaking, a total cost of $2,156.52. Paragraph 6 contains a summary description of the changes made to each section. I won't read them in detail, but if you have any specific questions, I'll try and answer them. These rules are essentially housekeeping rules to reflect current practice. I also would like you to note that on 7502.7.129 must have been mistakenly added to pages 63 to 65 of the October 2011 supplement, as the department is not proposing any changes to that section. As set forth in paragraph 7, 8, 10, and 11, of the report, the proposed amendments are not expected to have any impact on the regulated community in excess of 50,000. Regulatory analysis, small entity regulatory analysis, small entity economic impact statement, and a constitutional takings assessment were prepared and are attached to this report. The rules are non-emergency rules. These rules do not have any fiscal impact on the state revenues and expenditures, including any funds controlled by the department. And finally, Leanne Thiel is here to answer any questions that the community may have on the rules.
Okay. Very good. Questions from the committee? This committee is unusually quiet today. All right, seeing none, thank you. Another set coming for those of you on the phone. Please proceed.
Chairman Koppelman, members of the committee, again, my name is Jonathan Alm, attorney for Department of Human Services. The rules that are before you are North Dakota Administrative Code, Chapter 750209, rate setting for psychiatric residential treatment facilities. Again, these rules are non-responsive to legislation or federal enactments. Paragraph 3 and 4 of the report explains our notice and public hearing process. The department did not receive any comments on these rules. Paragraph 5 explains our cost setting of the, or cost of the rulemaking, a total cost of $2,018.40. Paragraph 6 contains a summary description of the changes made to each section of Chapter 750209. I won't read them in detail, but if you have specific questions, we'll try to answer them. These rules are essentially housekeeping rules to reflect current practice and to correct references to psychiatric residential treatment facilities. Again, the rules are not in response to legislation or federal enactments. As set forth in paragraph 7, 8, 10, and 11 of the report, the proposed amendments are not expected to have an impact on the regulated community in excess of 50,000. Regulatory analysis, small entity regulatory analysis, small entity economic impact statement, and a constitutional takings assessment were prepared and are attached to this report. The rules are not emergency rules. These rules do not have a fiscal impact on the state revenues or expenditures, including on any funds controlled by the department. And again, Leanne Thiel is here to answer any questions the committee may have.
Okay, thank you. Could you perhaps summarize what the effect of the rules are? And I guess one specific question I have, you said they're basically housekeeping rules to reflect current practice. That always makes me a little nervous because it implies that current practice might be different than current rules, and we're putting the rules in place to support what we're already doing. Is that the case here, or?
Chairman Koppelman, I'm going to have to ask Leanne Thiel. Right.
Thank you.
Chairman Koppelman and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Leanne Thiel with the Department of Human Services. Basic housekeeping rules, we used to call these facilities residential treatment centers. They've since been renamed to a psychiatric residential treatment facility. And instead of going in right away and changing everything from center to facility, we kind of waited and make sure and went through and did all necessary changes to the rules. So we didn't go through that right away.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Specific areas you'd like enlightenment or clarification on, or any other questions? Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it wasn't a question, but for Jonathan, we got an email this morning providing us with a little information on the rules that you had, and it answered the one question I had. But it, you know, for some of the people that don't have it on their phone or don't have their computers with them, it would have been nice if they could have had that at the end of last week. I don't know when you sent it out because I don't know how the system works, but it was, what did we say? It was marked like 8:24 or something this morning that that email was sent. So, remember what?
8:25.
Yeah, you can look at it here. Representative Thorson has it on his machine, but I don't know. You know, I've given you a heads up, I guess, that if you're going to do that, we appreciate it, but we just need it a little earlier than the day of the meeting. If we don't bring computers with us, most of us won't see it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not familiar with what the email was or what the question is. I know Julie Lear usually handles this, and she's at a conference out of state, so she asked me to step in. So I don't know what any kind of previous discussions or not. I'd has got my testimony to present.
That is a good note, though, to take back, perhaps, to the
yes.
department to make note of that. Any other comments or questions from the committee?
Oh,
right. Yes, Senator Citi.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, I'm quite sure that it was the notice in the first packet that he handed out from Shelley Peterson. So we do have a copy of it here, and I think that was the email we received this morning.
All right. Anything further? All right, seeing nothing, thank you very much. And the last item on the agenda before committee discussion is actually a 225 item, so I'm not sure if we have the representatives from the Workforce Safety and Insurance present. Yes, they are. They're nodding. Please come forward. And just as you're passing your material out, just a note, we do appreciate you coming in a little early. I know sometimes you have other things to do than sitting through the other presentations, but it is a convenience for the committee because, as you've seen today, sometimes we get ahead of schedule, which is a nice surprise. All right, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ann Jorgensen-Green. I am staff counsel with Workforce Safety and Insurance, here to testify before this committee on this rule. I submit for your review responses to the questions posed by legislative counsel in their organizational materials. I'll direct you to section 6 of the document in front of you, which outlines the subject matter and the reasons for this proposed amendment. Section 6 reads, the purpose of the creation of this rule to Administrative Code section 920102.22, out-of-state coverage for law enforcement training, is to extend to law enforcement personnel who are required to be out of state for training, to extend to those individuals workers' compensation coverage for a limited period of time, provided that the North Dakota employer provides documentation that the workers' compensation system of that other state is not applicable to the employer. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Banning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess one of the questions I have had with the floods that we've had, I know our local sheriff in Cass County, he was down in South Dakota helping out with some assistance down there. Would he be covered total and workers' comp, being he's going down there? I don't know how it's worked out, if there's a joint powers agreement or if it's a volunteer type of basis. But would he be covered under North Dakota workers' comp or South Dakota's workers' comp?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banning, North Dakota Work Comp provides limited coverage for out-of-state exposure, that being North Dakota employers who take their employees outside of the state for a period of 30 days. So if indeed in your situation those sheriffs or those sheriff's deputies were out of state for less than 30 days, North Dakota Work Comp would apply.
So if I can continue, so if it's over 30 days, they would have to do some other type of policy with the other state, or how would that work at the back of then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banning, that's where the issue begins to get a little bit gray. Certainly a North Dakota employer who has North Dakota employees and someone gets hurt on the job, that seems kind of intuitively to be a North Dakota claim. The constraints of North Dakota work comp being a monopoly and other states being members of the private insurance market creates sometimes a little bit of a challenge in terms of coverage. 99% of the time, that scenario that you've laid out would be covered under North Dakota work comp. If, let's just extend your your scenario a step. Let's say that your sheriff's deputies were out of state for 6 months. Then South Dakota in that situation might say, well, gosh, you now have significant contacts here in South Dakota, and it's incumbent upon you to get coverage in South Dakota. That's really the purpose behind this rule, specifically addressing those law enforcement personnel, specifically police officers, who go to Virginia for training. The training by itself lasts more than 30 days. We want to make sure that our police officers, if they're injured during their training, have coverage with us.
Ms. Green, the legislature passed a bill this session dealing with joint powers agreements specifically for state-to-state type issues, and I think one of the reasons was this very concern of, I think part of it had to do with authority in terms of, for example, in Cass and Clay County, which are Grand Forks, East Grand Forks, I'm sure is similar, maybe Richland and Wilkin, the same thing. When they do assistance across state lines, oftentimes there was a concern, I know from the Cass County Sheriff, about having to deputize people and the question of whether the authority was the same, whether the coverage was the same. So those JPAs work very well within our state, but I know we passed legislation this session to make sure that it was reciprocal state to state. And I think Minnesota has something similar on the books. Do you know how that affects work comp?
Mr. Chairman, to the best of my knowledge, certainly joint powers agreements are quite handy when it comes to dealing with agency to agency kinds of situations. The difference here is that the Workforce Safety and Insurance is a state agency. We're not an insurance company. As a consequence, we're not a licensed insurer like Liberty Mutual or Aon Re or any of the big insurance companies. Conversely, Liberty Mutual can't come into North Dakota and write work comp coverage. We're the only game in town, so to speak. But I'd be happy to look into that, sure, into that new legislation.
Yeah, that might be helpful, especially dealing with this kind of an issue.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? All right.
I have one.
Oh, yes. Our counsel.
Curiosity. This rule covers training for law enforcement. What if I, as a law enforcement officer, am in hot pursuit of a speeding felon who crosses the state line, and I go after him? Does my coverage end at the line?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Walstead, I certainly hope that the hot pursuit does not exceed 30 days.
But this is only, it says training.
Several states.
That's correct, sir.
Am I training when I'm doing that?
No, Mr. Walstead, you're not. But that hot pursuit presumably is close in time to the time that you started chasing that offender, so coverage would follow you.
And that's the coverage that already exists. This rule specifically deals with training, is what you're...
Yes. Mr. Chairman, yes.
There's another rule that I'm not seeing.
Further questions, comments from the committee? Representative Ammerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if some entity, county, or whatever uses this, is there, if it's used a lot, they train their people out of state, is there a bump in premiums? Does this affect premiums at all, you know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ammerman, no. It will not affect premium.
Very good. Further questions? All right, pretty straightforward. Your supporting documents are much more voluminous than your rule, but...
I apologize.
All right. Thank you, Ann, and thank you both for presenting. That brings us to members of the committee, to committee discussion and directives. As you know, one of the authorities, I don't think we've had anything real controversial that we haven't dealt with today, but one of the authorities that the committee has is to hold rules over for consideration or void rules that we have issues with. I haven't heard anything to indicate that those exist in this meeting, but if there are, please bring that forward. Any other comments, questions, smart remarks for the good of the order?
Well, now that you bring that up, I just wanted to express my appreciation when Mr. Hudick talked about the annual license fee for lawyers. I thought for sure somebody would say that
maybe there should be a nuisance tax or something in addition, but anyway, thank you.
Out of respect for our council, we restrained ourselves. Members of the committee, I have not discussed yet with council when we'll meet for our next meeting, but we are required, I think, by December 15th, if I'm not mistaken, to do that. I have been told by some members of the committee that there are other meetings that have been or are being scheduled that will be in that general timeframe, so we will look at that for your convenience and see if there's an opportunity to butt our meeting, you know, a day apart and butt them together so that we can save you a trip if that's logical and possible. If there's nothing further, we are ahead of schedule and we'll stand adjourned.
Thank you for making this arrangement, John.
Not a problem.
Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Thanks, Kim.
Thank you. I'm just thinking about the 4 hours I don't have to drive it home again.
Well, we'll save you a little time. You can do a little extra yard work. That's okay. Oh, let's see, I better turn this off.